You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. So goes the line from the 8th century Harmony of Difference and Equality Sutra, which Colleen Morton Bush quotes in her exquisite book, Fire Monks, Zen Mind Meets Wildfire at the Gates of Tassajara. And those lines could also serve as the introduction to the four-part series, which we debut tonight, titled The Elemental West, Fire, Water, Earth, Air, which is a collaboration between Aloud and the USC Huntington Institute on California and the West. The series features writers whose work explores the American West through the elements, although I think Bill will attest we don't know that we can ever come up as great a combination to discuss fire as authors of the last names Pine and Bush, but that's really extraordinary. How can each of the four elements serve as a lens, a framing device for writers to describe, understand, and transmit their understanding of the West, our particular history, ecology, outlook, the evolution of our literature? So tonight we look through the lens, perhaps I should say the haze, of a spectacular fire. Actually, it was 2,000 wildfires, all started by a single lightning storm that blazed across California in June 2008. The Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, established by Suzuki Roshi in 1967, was sited and is sited in a narrow canyon in the epicenter of that raging wildfire. In her just-published book, Fire Monks, Zen Mind Meets Wildfire at the Gates of Tassajara, Colleen Morton Bush tells the story of how five monks, summoning both intuition and wisdom, risked their lives to save Tassajara from burning down, and how they faced that crisis with startling clarity. She bases her book on extensive interviews with those monks, their friends and families, with firefighters, residents of the area, and she tells her story with great heart and great insight, illuminating how Buddhist principles were a guiding force in the midst of disaster. Colleen's nonfiction, poetry, and fiction have appeared in a wide range of publications, from literary magazines to the San Francisco Chronicle and Yoga Journal, where she was a senior editor. She's been a Zen student since 2000. And we welcome her here tonight from the Bay Area. Offering perspective from a lifelong study of fire to our discussion tonight is Stephen Pine, one of the country's preeminent experts on wildfires and a noted author himself. Steve is a MacArthur Fellow. He's a professor at Arizona State University and the author of over 20 books, mostly dealing with the history, ecology, and management of fire. He has also authored books on the history of exploration, notably How the Canyon Became Ground, The Ice, A Journey in Antarctica, and most recently, Voyager, Seeking Newer Worlds in the Third Great Age of Discovery. And both interests, fire and exploration, grew out of 15 seasons. He worked the North Rim Long Shots, a fire crew at Grand Canyon National Park, and he's currently researching a fire history of the United States over the past 50 years. And both of our authors will be signing books tonight afterwards in the lobby. And moderating the discussion tonight is my series co-curator, William Deverell, the director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West, and a professor of history at USC. Among Bill's books are Whitewashed Adobe, The Rise of Los Angeles and the Remaking of Its Mexican Past, and Railroad Crossing, Californians and the Railroad, 1850 to 1910. Tonight's program collaboration evolved out of our spirited conversations, and I really want to thank Bill and the Huntington Institute on California and the West for their spirit of scholarship and adventure, and I'm looking forward to exploring water, air, and earth in seasons to come. Bill will take it away after the conversation. He'll open to you, and we just ask that you wait until the microphone comes to you as we record for podcast. Please give our distinguished panel a warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Thanks to everyone for coming. Thanks especially to our two panelists tonight. It is a distinct pleasure to be associated with the Aloud series and the Library Foundation. Aloud's a public gem in our vast metropolis, and I'm thrilled to be partnering, as Louise mentioned, on our series, Exploring the Elemental West and Writers Who Think About It. Any serious student of the American West encounters fire. There's always been fire. We see it everywhere, in indigenous practices of land or natural resource management, in Western overland migrations, either the campfire shimmering in the evening or the lightning strike runaway wildfire scorching the prairie. We see deliberate fire begun by indigenous peoples and migrants both. We see accidental fire, a campfire leaping to grasses and trees, a controlled fire racing beyond borders, a fire born of firearms and black powder, a fire of pyrotechnic amusement suddenly gone awry. We see fires born of climate origin, heat, fuel, and aridity as fire starters. We see lightning fires, and of course we see fires in Old West settings. Wooden structures hastily built in gold and silver rushes, water supplies nearby but often turned to the business of mining more efficiently than that business of fire suppression. We'd have many more ghost towns in the American West than we have had fire not been so omnipresent and opportunistic. Nor does fire stop, of course, as we move into the post-frontier West. After all, San Francisco burned for 4 days by way of dozens of post-earthquake fires in 1906, with probably as many causes as there were fires. Gas line ruptures, inept use of dynamite, cook stoves and cooking fires out of control, fires pinned on insurance hopes, and so on. So fire is always and everywhere. But seeing it in the historical record, recognizing it as ever-present, isn't, of course, anything like truly understanding it. Colleen's work on the Tassajara fire of 2008 begins with Steve Pine, noting that fire is, quote, more than an ecological process or an environmental problem. It is a relationship. Now, that sounds straightforward, almost as if it's a mere observation. But I don't think it is. I think it's really an argument. And I want to ask Steve about that insight as we begin. Can you parse your words a little bit for us, Steve, maybe by lingering on the American West and on those three characters of fire you denote, ecological process, environmental problem, and then, in some respects, the synthesis of that equation, a relationship. Tell us where those ideas come from in your own writing and sense of fire.
Well, I think the operating proposition I have is that we are a uniquely fire creature on a uniquely fire planet. And fire is what we do as a species. We have a species monopoly over it. We're never going to allow any other creature to have that power. Our world would unravel very quickly without that. Now, we don't control fire completely. Nature has its own autonomy and so forth. But this is what we do. Other animals knock over trees and dig holes in the ground. We do fire. So I see it as pretty much a kind of ecological signature of who we are. So for a historian interested in questions, what makes us human, who are we, identity, fire is a very useful bridge, weld between the natural world over which we have little control and the world that we try to make out of it. So that's constantly negotiated. We can't exist without fire. In fact, their evidence now is suggesting that we are physiologically dependent on cooked food. We cannot live on raw food alone. So we have, in fact, a relationship with fire. We made, in some ways, a Faustian bargain a long, long time ago that we would promote fire. Fire would help us, but we each get in each other's way. So fire is all over the West. If people left, we would still have fire burning. But with people here, fire is different. And so what I find interesting is how does that change? And what does that tell us about us? Because we're making choices. We're creating institutions. We have different fire than Canada does. We have California has different fire than Mediterranean climates in South Africa or Australia. So I find it a very useful device as a way of fleshing out those things, because though fire is not alive, it is a creation of the living world, and though it isn't a moral agent, it forces us to act and to choose. So it becomes a very convenient way, as well as a nice plot device, right? You know, beginning, middle, and end story. So I don't want to talk too much. The other academic sin, abstraction and then talking too much. So let me end it at that, and we can come back later if we want.
Well, it's exactly that relational dialogue that gets to the very heart of Colleen's book. So let me turn to Colleen now at the start of our dialogue. I want to start with something you wrote on the very last page of your book, actually two things. So you start off with Steve's argument or observation about fire as a relationship, and that notion, a complex notion of fire in human history. And then, Colleen, one is you have an observation from one of the book's chief protagonists, Abbot Steve. You talked to him about history with specific reference to fire and wondered about the possible tensions between Zen awareness of and even indulgence in the present versus possible useful and helpful perspectives on the past, in particular, this book that could perhaps offer some vision about both the past and also a primer in some respects, perhaps, about how you might address fire when it comes again. In particular, with the dialogue between past and present, you wondered, does knowing about a fire help you contemplate the next one? And he responded to you in this wonderful line, that there is no present that does not include the past. Now, that sounds very much like Zen to me, with a dash of William Faulkner in there, with his insistence that the past is never dead. And as an historian, of course, I love it. I love that notion, and I agree with it mightily. But take us through, if you will, the past and present of Tassajara as a place, at least leading up to the summer of 2008 and the story you tell in this book. What, why, and where is it? And how does fire begin to creep in to the story?
Well, Tassajara is about 10 miles inland from Big Sur in the Ventana Wilderness in a very remote and isolated area. And the first thing that's popping to mind is that, you know, fire has always been a part of that landscape. Fire is absolutely indigenous to that landscape. And Abbot Steve very much knows that when he makes that comment. It's also been part of Tassajara's history. So in the book, I talk about several of the fires that have come through Tassajara in the past. And there's the past that is informing the present. So in the book, I'm mostly writing about a fire that happens in 2008. But all of the decisions that are made, the thought processes that are going on are informed by these prior experiences with fire at Tassajara on one hand. And on the other hand, there's the knowledge that that fire is probably not going to be this fire. So we can learn from the past, we can incorporate the past into our present moment, but we always have to recognize that, you know, we don't know what's coming.
And before we get to a more explicit discussion of the events of 2008 in the summer, give us a brief introduction to some of the individuals you focus on in the book. You do a masterful job at treating your characters with great care and sensitivity and bringing them to life in the midst of this incredibly dramatic and compelling series of moments. So tell us a little bit about who they are, and then tell us a little bit about this fascinating journey that many of them take from Western upbringing to life of spiritual devotion in a quite isolated Zen monastery.
Yeah, it's actually the whole book is very much not just focused on the five on the cover, but I do take you into the lives of these five because I wanted you to have guides through this story, and I also wanted to unfold it sort of as it happened for each of these individuals, which is very much an individual way. The abbot, for example, grew up in Kansas, Mennonite background, and I think what in his character or his persona, it's a little strange to call him a character since he's actually a real person, but I'm most interested in issues of authority and position. Here he is, he's the abbot. He's relatively new to this position of abbot when this fire comes through Tassajara. And he's working with and struggling with who's in charge? Who's in charge here? I'm the abbot of this monastery, I need to make decisions, but there's firefighters here telling me things, giving me orders. And so he's working with that. Another one of the primary characters, probably the most primary, is David Zimmerman, who was the director of Tassajara at the time of the fire. Much younger, he's in his early 40s when this happens. He had a very difficult childhood, was orphaned very early in his life, and you know, turned to Zen somewhere along the way, I think trying to find a home. But what Zen actually teaches is that, you know, home is here right now. Home is not actually a physical place. He's a priest. They're all priests that stay for the fire, which means that he's actually given up the idea of having a permanent home. A priest, that's part of their vows. But what I'm interested in exploring through David is this idea of having a home. Here we are, we're trying to protect it from a wildfire. It is a physical place, but it's a home for many, many people. I mean, 5,000 people pass through Tassajara in any given summer. It's not just, I don't know if the audience knows, it's a training center for serious Zen practitioners. And half of the year it's open, as in right now, it's open to people to just go and enjoy the hot springs, enjoy the food. So he is sort of in charge of running that in the summer. And he's also struggling with these questions of authority and not knowing what the right thing to do is. He doesn't know anything about fire. He doesn't know how to make decisions about people's safety.
Well, we're going to take you right up to the moment where the fire is threatening. But tell us a little bit about the routinized and fairly regularized and quite disciplined fire preparations that had taken place at Tassajara, the work they'd done in the awareness that this is absolutely fire country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they already actually, they have a fire crew permanently. It's full of students, but it's a fire crew that exists. They have an equipment shed that's always there. So that's there from the start. But they had spent about 3 weeks clearing brush, digging fire line, doing all the work that a professional fire crew would be doing. And they did have help. Professional crews, both Forest Service and CAL FIRE. They had a crew from Indiana coming in because the fire situation was so intense that, you know, firefighters were flocking from other states, helping them do this work. The most sort of elegant and charming, I think, thing that they did is they built a sprinkler system that stretched from one end of Tassajara to the other out of very basic materials, PVC pipe and sprinklers, garden supply materials. And they dubbed it Dharma Rain. So this has become, actually now they're working on installing a permanent sprinkler system called Dharma Rain. So they were not in the zendo, not in the meditation hall, really, for 3 weeks straight. They were working from dawn until dusk, getting Tassajara ready for this fire that might or might not arrive.
Great. Now, Steve, I'm going to ask you to do something I think quite difficult, but can you give us a thumbnail history of National Forest or public land firefighting regiments, teams, in this era? I mean, it's an incredibly dynamic policy and philosophy of fire and firefighting across the American West, but can you touch upon just the broader sense of the debates about fire and firefighting in a Western American setting in the last generation?
Let me back up, since we're historians, and get the narrative arc right here. We're actually in a centennial year. 100 years of the Weeks Act, which followed the Great Fires of 1910, which established federal-state cooperation programs for fire. So we've been doing this for a century now. It's also the centennial of L.A. County Fire Department, by the way. For the first 50 years, they moved heaven and earth to take fire out of the landscape. The last 50 years, they've been trying to find some way to put it back in. And to decide in this bifurcating world of it's either urban or it's really wild, and there's very little buffer zone. The rural landscape is vanishing around the West. So we've lost that zone where people used to do regular burning. We've lost that sort of safety zone. They have really struggled. Most of the action the National Park Service changed policy in 68 to try to encourage it. The Forest Service followed 10 years later. It was after the Yellowstone fires in 88 where we started getting some public traction. They're struggling to figure out how this is going to work. And what's happening is that nationally, we're seeing a kind of re-regionalization. So prescribed fire is going to stay in the South. Large sort of natural fire areas are going to be in the largest public lands of the West, and the rest of it is going to be pretty much suppression. And Southern California is really the ground zero for the modern sort of urban fire service out in the woods, which is what LA County has become, what CAL FIRE has become. They were a forestry group, and it's really what the Forest Service in California is. So instead of being fire management officers, they are fire chiefs. They all wear bugles on their lapels. That is unique to California. I might add just very briefly to both of those transitions, the debate over where that would happen centered in California. There was a large debate whether we begin after 1910 at that era, are we going to do it by regular burning or are we going to do it by a kind of paramilitary suppression? That was fought out in Northern California. And the debates about where fire policy should go in the last 50 years, a lot of that was in Southern California for the suppression, urban, so really all-risk model, and then in the Sierra Parks for the natural fire program. What's missing is that middle ground in the West. And that seems to be pretty well rooted in the South, where it's a traditional practice and other things. So in a nutshell, that's where it is. I'd like to say we figured it out. I'm from Arizona. We just had 1 million acres burn. I'm thinking 100 years of lessons learned, science, high caliber science for decades, specialized fire labs, enough hardware to take on the military of half the world, and this is what we have to show for it. No, I'm not going to accept that. I'm not going to end that story ironically, but I'm telling you we're going to have to think how not to end it ironically. Is this really where we're at?
I love it when we go back to 1910 as an historian. One review I read of Colleen's book noted that she pairs in the book two priesthoods standing together and also antagonistically at the edge of fire in the Tassajara arena. The priesthood of the monastery and the priesthood of expert firefighting. And I should say that's the reviewer's sense of it. It's not the way Colleen describes these two columns. Now, I'll surely grant the first characterization that there is a priesthood at this monastery. But, Steve, for you, is the U.S. Forest Service or CAL FIRE or California Department of Forestry, is that able to shoulder a priesthood designation? And also, if so, weren't you a deacon in that church?
Well, that's giving us a lot more credit than we deserve. I was just a smoke chaser when I started. That was the old term. We were just one step away from basic rural laborers. That instead of wrangling cattle or cutting trees, you dug fire line. And now it's a first responder thing. It's a very, very different world. So I was in part of that transition. The fire community would like to say that it is professional or professionalized. They aren't. They're a guild. The extreme version of the guild are the urban fire services, where you're highly urbanized.
Can you explain the differences there a little bit? Profession versus guild?
Well, I don't think it's just, they think because you have a lot of training or maybe college education that you are professional. Well, you're highly trained, but you're a skilled worker with perhaps highly specialized skills and talents. That is not, to my mind, a profession. I'm not sure. I think the professional would require a certain higher level of abstraction and I think perhaps a wider adaptability. I'm going to slide by that. I'm not sure how to define it. I feel a lot more confident about the fire community. I was a member proudly for many years, and it's a group basically that thinks with its hands. Mm-hmm. And they want to do stuff. This is an operational process. It is not an abstraction. And if you begin wandering and thinking abstractly, you're not going to be in the gene pool very long.
Right. Got it. Okay. Now let's turn to the summer of 2008. Colleen, can you sketch for us a little bit about that season of fire, with particular reference to your setting? And then as you develop this story about what happened at Tassajara and the decisions that were made and the choice to stay, etc., that might offer you a chance to read a bit from this wonderful book. So start with the season of fire, and then get us on the ground there with some of the difficulty about deciding what to do.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add first that when Steve was saying, think with their hands, Zen students think with their bodies. They don't necessarily think with their minds. They think with intuition, which is not necessarily rooted here. So, 2008, I mean, many people here probably remember that summer. It was extraordinary just to have the state completely overwhelmed with wildfires stretching from one end to the other. And Tassajara was in between two very large ones, the Indians fire and the Basin Complex fire. There's a photo in the book that looks like kind of like a crab claw. You know, here's Tassajara and here's those two fires. And they did not want to leave. They never planned to leave the monastery, largely because it had been done before. They had been able to stay during the 1977 Marble Cone fire, during which Steve was actually near Tassajara working as a firefighter. And they had stayed in 1999, the Kirk Complex fire. So they had these references. They were being told, though, please leave, repeatedly. By the Forest Service, which was in charge of that area. Basically, they're in the Los Padres National Forest, so they're in Forest Service lands. So that's who's calling the shots. They kept delicately negotiating, trying to say, but look, we've got this sprinkler system, but look, we've done all this training, but look, we, you know, not getting anywhere. And but the conversation kept going, and finally, the weather shifted dramatically around, actually it was July 9th, and it was 3 weeks into this whole thing, where the temperatures were going to skyrocket, the winds were going to whip up, and things drastically shifted. They had a firefighter on the ground with them who was a CAL FIRE, is a CAL FIRE captain near Santa Cruz, but he was only there in an off-duty capacity. He was just a friend of Tassajara. He had no authority on the fire, but he had a firefighter's awareness of everything that could potentially go wrong, right? And also of what it would feel like for him if something did go wrong. So he changed his tune at the last minute and advised them to get out. When all along they've been planning to stay. The one other thing to say about that is that Tassajara is reached by a single road. One cannot get in there unless you go in on foot over incredibly rugged terrain or chopper in or whatever. It's one rugged dirt road, and this was of real concern to the professional firefighters because when you only have one road in and out, if that road is compromised, there's no way to get anybody or resources in or anyone out. So should I read a little bit from, I'm going to read from a scene where they, basically this CAL FIRE captain who's on the ground with them, who in this scene, is his name is Stuart. That's really the only name you need to worry about. Everybody else is a resident of Tassajara. He's just initiated their evacuation pretty much without consulting them. He's called up to a firefighter up the road who is in the official line of duty and initiated air tankers to drop water on the road so that they can get out. And now they're having a meeting, a very quick and hasty meeting, trying to get on the same page as him. They all heard David's announcement over their radios, the activation group at the flats waiting for their next cue. Shundo and Devon, who'd hiked over the Hogback for a look at the fire up Tassajara Creek. A skeleton kitchen crew preparing supper. Abbott Steve on his way to the work circle to intercept the three returning from Lime Point. Everyone on the core team, please come to the stone office immediately. Abbott Steve ran into Stuart first, near the gatehouse across from the Zendo. We're leaving, the fire captain told the Abbott. He lifted his gaze to the smoke-washed sky above the half-wrapped gatehouse. What? Abbott Steve peered at Stuart through frameless eyeglasses, projecting a naturally confident, cool demeanor despite Stuart's urgency. You don't like this, do you? Stuart shifted on his feet. No, I don't. In the weeks since Abbott Steve had arrived at Tassajara, they'd been doing everything they could to stay there safely, not to leave it. The Abbott knew the activation had not been exemplary. He was there, and he'd witnessed the confusion of hoses and rolls, the nervous lack of focus. But that alone couldn't have so drastically shifted Stuart's commitment to staying. What did you see from Lime Point? The fire's approaching the road, Stuart said. They're sending air support to keep it clear. We have 10 minutes to get out of here. The fire reaching the road might be a trigger point for the fire service, Abbott Steve thought, but it wasn't a trigger point for him. Just a few days prior, he'd talked with a reporter on the bridge just above where Cabarga Creek spills into Tassajara Creek in the rainy months. Summer guests and residents often relax on its benches made of long, smooth slabs of wood. If the fire comes to visit us at our front steps, the Abbott had said as sunlight splashed the head student's cabin behind him, we'll meet it. The sun had set and the moon had risen several times since he'd made that assessment, but it hadn't changed. This isn't the agreement we had, Stuart, he said. It's not how we make decisions here. Alone, Stellar's Jay squawked on the hill behind the gatehouse, one of the many that usually patrol Tassajara looking for handouts and crumbs. Most of the wildlife seemed to have cleared out in advance of the fire. Stuart sucked in a breath and turned his gaze in the direction of the Hogback, the low ridge where earlier he'd seen fountains of flame spilling down the canyon toward Tassajara. He shifted his weight from side to side and blew out the intake of air, shaking his head. We have to leave, he repeated. Stuart was all motion, but the Abbott held his body still, his movements frugal, precise. We have a designated safe retreat, Stuart. We have our sprinklers and pumps to take care of. You yourself said, it's a different fire today than it was yesterday, Stuart interrupted. the wind rattled the wrapping on the gatehouse. "They're calling for red flag conditions. We're alone here. I've got no backup. We don't have the capacity to do this by ourselves, not in these conditions, and I don't want to be responsible for what could happen. We have to leave." "We need to discuss this with the core team," said Abbot Steve, reiterating what David had told Stuart on the road. The abbot turned back toward the stone office, walking past the small altar where ordinarily incense is offered in the work circle. Stuart, incredulous, trailed a few steps behind as they passed the kitchen. On a typical summer day, sounds of pots banging and knives chopping, one meal's cleanup and another's preparation, would float from the windows. Now it was quiet. Only one or two people were needed to prepare a simple dinner for the 22 who remained. The reassuring murmur of Tassajara Creek drifted through the windows of the open-air student eating area where Abbot Steve had sat his first practice period at Tassajara. That was before the Zendo burned, and he remembered exactly where his seat had been, facing the creek near the door. His legs had felt every kind of pain, throbbing, tingling, cramping, aching, even burning, but he'd sat through it all, watching how the mind tries again and again to refuse to feel what is unpleasant, unwanted. Now simply watching his own response was not an option. According to Stuart, this fire had become a different fire. That was entirely possible. Every fire was different from one moment to the next, just like everything in the universe. Despite their less-than-perfect activation, Abbot Steve thought they were ready. The words he'd said earlier to the reporter were still true. Stuart had said he didn't want to be responsible for what could happen, but in Abbot Steve's view, that responsibility fell to the core team. If they left, as Stuart said they had to, the pumps drawing water into the standpipe system and pushing it through Dharma Rain would run out of fuel. The sprinklers would sputter and stop on the rooftops. The fire would pour into that vacuum. Even the stone kitchen would burn, as the old Zendo had, the fire consuming the cookbooks and the wooden shelves that held them, and warping the steel sinks and hanging racks used to cool freshly baked loaves of bread. Everything that could would burn. Abbot Steve was relatively new to his position. At the ceremony installing him as abbot, he'd taken a vow. "Having entered this path, I cannot turn aside." His first concern now was for everyone's safety, but his position gave him another responsibility, not lower or higher, but equally present, to tend to the practice and bring forth the teachings of the Buddha. It was responsibility in its broadest sense. To take care of Tassajara included taking care of the creek and the forest, the temple buildings, the bodies and minds of every resident and guest. The guardian of the temple, a foot-tall wooden figure with a furrowed brow and a stick balanced behind his bowing hands, had already been taken out to Jamesburg. The remaining residents and their embodiment of practice were the guardians of the temple now.
That's wonderful. So just draw this out a little bit for us. Is the motivation, obviously it's a complex set of motivations on the part of those that chose to remain, but it's beyond simply saving a place that they are devoted to or is so critical to their own devotional histories. Talk a little bit more about the situation about care. In other words, what I'd like you to do is flesh out for us a little bit Zen practice and the ways in which that informed the decision, not as to how they approach the fire, but how they approach staying.
The question came up after the fire. There was a blog that was keeping people out there informed about what was happening down in the valley because so many people are connected to Tassajara, in fact, all over the world. And the question came up, well, you know, don't Buddhists believe in non-attachment? So what are you doing? Risking your lives down there to protect these buildings that can be rebuilt? Good question. But it's a little bit of a misunderstanding of non-attachment. You know, non-attachment doesn't mean that you don't take care of what's yours to take care of. And this is, you know, this place is not only a training place, it allows people to come in there and to get some feeling for what's being done there and they're touched by it. People who are not Zen practitioners at all, simply by being there and being around that environment, you use the word taking care, which I use a lot in the book. Zen is very much about, you know, I want to treat this with the same amount of respect as I would treat my own hand, my own eyes. you know, when you see a Zen student, you know, chopping a carrot, it can be an absolutely amazing experience because they're putting all of their attention into that moment. They're really truly there chopping that carrot. They're not spaced out, or they trying not to be, thinking about something else. And there's a moment in the book where I say it could have been a soup that needed stirring. It could have been a broom that needed putting away. On July 10th, it happened to be a fire hose. And I mean that really truly, that, and they talk about it that way, that it was just the thing that needed to be done. It was their, you know, their task at that moment was to, what it meant to take care of Tassajara was to meet this fire. For some people, it meant to leave. As you note, not everybody made that decision to leave. But for those who chose to stay, it was just the thing that needed doing.
And that almost prosaic sense of it was the thing that needed doing, tell us a little bit more about the, and Steve, I'll ask you to reflect on this personally too. When you fight fire like this, tell us a little bit more about the dialogue between fear and exhilaration, particularly for your people.
Yeah. You know, they had moments of fear. They had moments where what ended up happening is the fire did not creep in. In fact, the fire came in much more aggressively than they even had pictured on all sides at once. And Tassajara is at the bottom of a very deep canyon, you know, with a creek running through it, thank goodness, but nonetheless, very dramatic arrival of this fire. And they all sort of describe moments of, you know, oh dear, you know, what have we made a mistake? Have we made a grave mistake? And they had a building there that's got 2-foot-thick stone walls. It's the stone office. And that was their safe haven. They had food in there. They had oxygen. They had, a way to go to the bathroom if they were stuck in there for a long time. They had fire shelters. And that was supposed to be where they were going to go if they got caught in a firestorm. But they didn't even... they didn't even talk about it. They just sort of like all dispersed, because what happened is the fire came in and it met the moisture level and it went, you know, and then it started to slow. So they didn't stay with that fear. That fear, they felt it, they registered it, and then partly because of what was actually happening, they were able to let go of it and just do what needed doing next, which was, okay, somebody needs to go down here and someone needs to go to the shop where there's big propane tanks and lots of lumber. And they just got to work. So, you know, there were moments, but they didn't hold on to them and they didn't run away with them into what's going to happen to me. What's, you know, they stayed with what needed actually to be done in that moment.
I'll turn to you in a second, Steve, but that's where the discipline and the attachment, if I can use that word, to work took over, almost instinctually. I mean, the power of the training?
Yeah, I think so. You just do what you've been given to do. Zen students trade jobs a lot. It's an interesting situation because you can be there for years like a lot of these people have, and you can hold so many different positions. You don't get an expertise in any one position. You know, you're the cook one year, and the next year you're the plant manager. The idea is to put you in a situation not where you necessarily have the expertise, but where you are in a place of not knowing, you know, what you have the mind of a beginner, which was Suzuki Roshi's teaching, you know, the founder of this temple, that the mind of the beginner is open. There's many possibilities in the mind of a beginner. If you're an expert, you might close down the options. So it was just they have that training to be open to facing what they don't know.
And Steve, care to comment on fear and exhilaration?
Well, I mean, part of the success of firefighting is not to be at the receiving end of the fire. And the whole strategy is to be at the other end, and you flank it. And we were successful at that regard, so I didn't find myself in those circumstances. And frankly, I was 18. I was immortal.
Yeah.
I mean, fear... You know, this is just exhilaration. Our crew motto was flame and fortune, money and action. I mean, this was kind of extreme sport, you know. And that's, you know, that's what it was about. So I think we could be faulted for being too callow, maybe, not having a proper sense of respect. But that also depends, you know, what kinds of fires you deal with. And the fires that kill people tend not to be really big fires. They tend to be small parts of bigger fires or areas where wind shifts, sudden gusts, changes, chimneys, other things combined with grass or light stuff that can react quickly, suddenly causes a flash where you don't have chance to take some kind of evasive action. That's what repeatedly does people in. And we simply weren't in that setting. Our threat was when the fire started on the rim and then spilled over the canyon where we had vegetation. Well, we're not going down to do that, and so we would have to find some way to maneuver around it. But so I personally didn't know a lot of fear, not because I'm fearless, but because I was young and dumb, and we were just having too much fun and too busy, and there was just so much camaraderie, and you're just sort of exhilarating, you know, just the whole place.
I just want to add something that, you know, for them, that, you know, I think fear comes from an idea of there's something to defend, there's something to preserve, and they really were not, when they saw that fire come in. In fact, there's a very incredible video clip that one of the people took that as the fire was coming in. She took like a 16-second video before she realized, better put my camera down and, you know, do something here. And what you hear in her voice when she's saying, there's the fire on Flag Rock, there's the fire on Hawk Mountain, is absolute awe. I don't actually hear fear, I hear awe. So I asked her about that. And I think when you're not when you're not worried about defending something or protecting something, and you're just seeing that fire, it's stunning. It's absolutely beautiful. People described to me repeatedly, and I'm sure you had moments where you're standing on the rim looking at fire and just looking at it as fire, seeing its beauty and not being caught up in danger, this is dangerous, this is bad, this is any of those kind of more judgmental attributes.
Well, we had lots of bad fires, and all these fires took on a certain character because they force you into certain choices and reactions. And so, I mean,
but
we
have
really...
Do you ever just admire them for their beauty?
Sometimes, but, you know, we were paid to put them out. So there's a limited amount of beauty that's available. The beauty is, how long is it going to take us to put this thing out, and how much overtime am I going to make on it? Like at that point. I'm not trying to be too cavalier here. But, you know, we had fun. They were really sweet fires. This is lovely. This was a hoot. Others that were just awful fire. You know, we got to name fires. We'd have misfires. We'd recoup fire. Recoup is puker spelled backwards, because this thing was lodged in this impenetrable mixed conifer forest that you just had to stagger up and down over to reach. A terrible fire, or a fire where there's no dirt. So they all had a kind of character to them. And we talked earlier about this. I think in a way what it taught me was that how you can animate fire without anthropomorphizing it. And you can give fire, let it function in a literary sense as a character without really making it a character.
Here's where I'd like you to develop that a little bit. So we talked before, as we were chatting before we stepped out here, about the regime of publicly funded governmental agency firefighting and some reach or some embrace of technocratic culture, etc. That's entirely, at least on the monastery side of the story that Colleen tells us, that's entirely absent from this. This is a different approach, a relational approach to fire, a certain level of personal and group discipline about what it is they're involved in. Steve, from your perspective as a student of firefighting,
excuse me,
are there lessons to be learned from the ways in which Colleen's figures approach these situations?
Sure.
Lessons to learn from the technocratic culture.
Sure. No, and that's entirely the case. And the agencies have invested an enormous amount of effort in this, particularly to protect firefighters. One reason fires are getting bigger is because they're not willing to put people at risk in the same way. The turning point is really the 1-2 punch, Norman MacLean's Young Men in Fire, and then Life Imitates Art 2 years later in Colorado, the South Canyon Fire, took out a crew of firefighters. It was almost the same story that MacLean had told, and that was what really galvanized the response. So the way they will treat it is a number of training methods, but a lot of interest in what's called high reliability organizations. They've brought a lot of people who study this. For example, aircraft carriers. I mean, how are you launching planes and receiving them constantly in, you know, a bouncing sea and the rest of it? And do any one of a thousand mistakes could turn lethal. How is it that that organization can perform at that level? Well, they're not learning Zen, but they are mastering some of the same sets of skills, but they are finding an institutional way to code that. So there's been a huge investment in that. So you can achieve the same kinds of results from lots of ways. I think one of the things I liked about the book was the way you use fire to elicit these various Zen principles, mm-hmm. and illustrate them, how this can come about. I think that works very nicely.
Tell us a little bit about Colleen, about not to be too crude about it, but why'd you write it? You know, what would you like this book to do? It's a beautiful book. It's a moving book. Your sense of place is really highly developed. You feel like you're there, really, at this very interesting place. So what are some of the sets of motivations that drew you to write it?
I was drawn in when I was actually up in Oregon, kind of escaping the smoke out camping when the fire came through Tassajara, but I've been tracking it the whole time. But I was drawn in when I read an account written by one of my principal characters in the story of their decision making around staying and going, because there were, you know, we're going to stay, oh no, we're going to go, and then, oh no, some of us are going to go back. And there was something there that just immediately riveted to me. I thought, I'm a student of this practice. Is there something that that I can pull out here that will be helpful to me and that might be helpful to others about, you know? So from the very beginning, the fire was not just this actual physical fire. For me, fire was a metaphor for any adversity, any uncertain thing, any potentially painful, harmful, threatening thing that is coming at you, and you have to figure out what the appropriate response is. What is the thing that you need to do in that moment? And so I was very interested in all the questions that raises, and I wanted to get at that moment for them in a way that would be more broad, that people could take it into their own into their own lives.
Wonderful. Colleen ends her book with the Buddha saying, "All is a flame." It's a metaphor, of course, or a very, very broad assessment of everything. Far richer in meaning than our little silly pun about pine and bush on fire, which I'm also attracted to. But it gives us much to ponder as we move to sharing another hot summer in the American West. And with this book as something to ponder, and Steve's rich histories of fire as something to ponder. Before turning to you all for questions, please join me very warmly in thanking our two panelists for their work and their insights and their conversation this evening. And in keeping with the clarifying vision of Zen teachings, let me remind you that there is no dumb question except for the question that remains unasked. There is, however, the long question. Which we'd prefer go unasked. So please wait for the microphones to come around, and the floor is open for your questions and comments.
In all of the decision-making that went on among the monks, do we stay, do we go, was there ever an entertainment of the question, will we die if we stay? Was death ever talked about? And if so, was that an outcome that was accepted by the group?
I don't think it was actually talked about in those terms. I think they held it, each of them sort of held it in their own minds as a possibility. And there is a couple in the book. Two of the people who stayed, they're actually a couple. They've been together years. And I think they did have late night conversations about it. It didn't, they felt safe. They felt like not only had they done all the work, but they sort of trusted the valley and the very principle that fire comes downhill slower than it burns uphill, and that they had an endless source of water, and that they knew each other intimately from years of practicing side by side, and there was just like a trust there. So I think, yes, they knew it was a possibility. It wasn't like they were oblivious to that. But stronger was this kind of confidence that they could handle it as a community and that Tassajara was well prepared and safe, which is why they went back.
So the rest of them left on the road to Jamesburg, and then the five that stayed, could you talk a little bit more about how they divided the work and what they actually did?
Yeah, they broke like every firefighter safety rule. I mean, they only had five. So the funny thing is they got up the road, then, you know, five turn around and come back, and the rest of the caravan, those 22, you know, so whatever the math is there, ended up in Jamesburg. And as soon as they got down to Tassajara, they called and said, you know, does anybody else think they might want to come, you know, back in? Because we're looking at this and we're saying there's only five of us. Tassajara's, you know, it takes maybe 15 minutes to walk from one end of the facility to the other. It stretches a lot along the creek. They could have used more. So they just kind of had to, it was a bit random. But it all happened in this sort of beautiful, organized way. The guy who was the head of the shop went to the shop, naturally. Mako, the one woman in the story, ended up way down at the other, at a far end where she lives. I think maybe there was something there, I don't know, in her consciousness that sent her out there. And they were in contact by radios. So they were literally, there were a few people that kind of stayed, Mako and Colin kind of stayed at the shop and at the flats where they were. And others kind of roamed around. They had radios. They called when they needed help. There's a way that Zen students eat their meals in the Zendo out of three bowls that are wrapped in cloths. And there's a very elaborate way of serving these meals, receiving the food, eating, lots of bowing. It's like a ballet. And when I heard them describing to me how they worked together, I thought, oh, it's Orioki breakfast. It's like, it's exactly Orioki breakfast. They just like knew each other so well and could rely on each other that it worked out, you know. But they, you know, firefighters are not supposed to be alone. They're supposed to always, you know, have someone sort of watching out for them. They're not supposed to get isolated and spread out. But they had to do the job. They didn't really have a choice. And they were lucky in that nothing failed catastrophically to, you know, make this ballet turn into something, you know, kind of ugly.
You talked about the trust that the five had among each other being part of what kept them, in a way, from thinking about death. Where are you in all this? And how, you said that you're also a student of Zen. Are you, do you have an internal conflict between being a student, a practitioner yourself, but then also being the journalist?
So the latter part of your question is what you're most interested in? No. I didn't see a conflict between my desire to get the story factually correct and my desire to, like, derive something from the story or to dive into it from a practitioner point of view and really understand what was happening from a practice point of view. I just didn't see them as competing, you know. And actually, you know, a review that was published did indicate that maybe I didn't have enough critical distance, but I just didn't see that as a problem. Because, in fact, what I wanted to offer was an inside view. And I don't think, you know, I knew these people somewhat before the fire. I knew them by name, but I didn't know them anywhere near as well as I know them now, of course. And it was a process of getting to know them, you know, and actually building that trust. But there was sort of a fundamental trust from the beginning because I was a Zen practitioner. And I would therefore speak the language and understand in my bones what this practice is about. So for me, it didn't feel like a conflict at all, actually. I just had these different hats.
Colleen, I'm wondering, when people come at you like wildfire, you know, things show up in your face. Can you compare and contrast the kind of Western approach of psychology, understanding people's motivation, thinking about your own motivation, what goes on in the, you know, the psychological mind versus the Zen mind, which I imagine is, okay, they're here, I have to deal with it, without worrying about why. They're just there, and it is. How do you work with understanding and dealing with and balancing those two parts?
Well, actually, a lot of people who are interested in psychology are also interested in Zen. And, you know, there's a lot of Buddhist psychologists because they're not necessarily, irreconcilable. They work well together. But I'm just trying to think in my own experience. I think in some ways they're very similar. I mean, if someone's coming at me like wildfire, I'm actually going to check in with myself. What's my response to this person? You know, am I wanting to get away from them or am I wishing they would go away? So it's Zen talks about taking the backward step and turning the light inward to yourself. So first, before you start psychoanalyzing them, why don't you check in with what's happening for you? Because that's actually the only thing you're in control of and can fully understand. And then, yeah, still meet them. So even if they're coming at you in all kinds of difficult ways, that you can actually, if you've done that, if you've kind of checked in with yourself first, you have better ground to stand on to actually meet them wherever they are, if it's angry or judgmental or, sad. Yeah.
In this process, there was a point where the decision was made to stay. Was that a good decision, given what they knew, given the facts of what they should have known, or was it a lucky decision?
I think it was a decision. It was a decision, and then things went the way they did. I asked that very same question of the abbot, like, what if someone had died? And he just refused to answer it because it's speculative and it's not what happened. And if it happened, we'd be dealing with it. You know, we'd be facing that. But they made the decisions that they could make based on what they knew at the time and what felt, quote unquote, right. But, you know, Zen really tries to get away from these labels of right and wrong. Good and bad decision. So nobody in this story will talk about their decision in that way. They'll just talk about it as the only decision I felt I could make in that moment. So I guess you could say it's a right decision and that it feels right to them in that moment. Did I come to a conclusion? Oh, they saved Tassajara. If they had not made that decision to go back, Tassajara most likely would be gone. I think both, actually. I mean, they were fortunate. There's no doubt that they were fortunate because things went well and the weather actually did not turn out to be as severe as the forecast had been. So they were fortunate, and I also think they made a wise decision. Yeah.
I have a question for the firefighter.
Yeah.
Good, because he wants to say something.
I was going to say something, follow up on that if I could quickly. I've been talking to people the last few days, local fire people and some others on this, and the longer a fire stays on the landscape, the more likely it is to blow up. It takes a whole set of special conditions to get big, and the longer you leave it around, the odds improve steadily. And basically you're dependent, the whole thing, whether it's a good decision or a bad decision, is going to depend on wind. Your life depends on gusts. A wind, and one guy put it, he says, you know, I make these decisions knowing that a wind shift could put me in jail. If it's wrong. So was it a right or wrong decision? It's very, we know it by the outcome. It looks okay, but you could have made a perfectly good decision and things completely out of your control. A squirrely wind comes by and it's gone. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I live in fire country locally here, and on optimum weather days, we were able to burn excess fuel in the wildlands. It was regulated by the fire department, but that practice was stopped due to, I believe, air pollution. Has the case been made that the air pollution is more damaging than that kind of brush removal?
Well, this is a tough. It's a tough arena because there are so many competing values. The argument is made also that it's going to burn. And having it burn in a wildfire is going to produce a lot more smoke under the worst possible conditions. So it's actually, from a public safety standpoint, probably much worse. On the other hand, if somebody lights a fire and that fire goes bad, they're going to be sued or arrested. And in fact, fire officers, even federal Forest Service, BLM, others, are now basically encouraged to take out personal liability insurance. That's not a real incentive to do much burning. And air quality is serious. I talked to the South Coast Air Quality Management District, and they said, well, legally, the only thing you can burn on your property is tumbleweeds. And that's basically on the other side of the hill that they would do it. And, you know, the ideal conditions to be able to burn, everything has to be in alignment. And then if it persists for any time, you're up against these rolling odds. The house odds are against you. And so the longer you keep spinning the roulette wheel, sooner or later, it's going to come up green and you're going to lose. And things work great. All fire practices, we have all kinds of strategies. We've got a century of sort of organized doing it. All of these different options work terrifically until they fail. And then when they fail so catastrophically that all the good you've done for the last 30 years is wiped out. So it's, I guess the contemporary term is black swan thing, or fire black and swan kind of issue, but it is that rare but catastrophic, very large event. Fire community has never solved that. And one reason they haven't solved it is because they keep thinking if they make incremental changes, it will disappear. And it doesn't. And I think what they need to do is just accept the big fire is the reality, and you build a program around it in such forms that when it comes, you lessen the damage and the expense and so forth. But that's another story we could go to.
I was curious in regard to what you said about high reliability organizations, what your thought was about the mismanagement of the station fire and the different organizations involved. I don't know if you can comment at all about that.
Yeah, I'm not prepared to comment on the station fire. I understand there's a GAO report coming out in 2 or 3 months. And talking to the Angeles National Forest, they will not discuss it. At this point, they'll say wait for that. So I don't know the details of how it was managed or not managed well. I can't comment.
As an ex-fireman and historian, I was curious, these monks stayed, that we always hear stories of people determined to stay. From your perspective, is that fair to the public safety, to the safety of the firefighters, and so forth?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that's not going to go away for several reasons. One is, for about 30 years now, Australia has been doing, it was really the leader in understanding how houses burn, how people get killed in these large fires. And what they found out was that most of the houses didn't burn in some tsunami of flame. They burn from little ground fire that just creeps up to the house, or embers. And many of the embers come afterwards. And they also found, so the main front has often passed before the house is burnt. And repeatedly, if you see these aerial views of these burned out communities, you see nothing but, you know, stone foundations and fireplaces, but the trees are still there. Well, how did that happen? Well, the trees are being ignited by the house, not the house. These are urban fires, and they burn house to house, or they burn with these other little things. Okay, so that's one thing, that if somebody was there, they could protect the house. What the other side of that was, these last-minute evacuations are when people get killed repeatedly. The worst, absolute worst, people are going to determine to stay, they're going to, or they just get the last minute, get in your car, you got 5 minutes to get out, the highway's clogged, smoke everywhere, huge noise. That's the other thing you don't appreciate about big fires. They are extremely noisy. You can't hear yourself think. And that's where people get killed. So they devised a program of actually, let's let people stay in the house. And the mantra was, houses save people, people save houses. And they developed programs that were very successful until Black Saturday of February 2009, when one of these really horrific fires blasted through. And this is an area that about every 30 years or so gets one of these things. And it's been doing so for 150 years that we know of. And there are some parts, and a lot of people killed, were killed. Well, they hadn't done the preparation. There were a lot of things that went wrong with that. But the program was partly blamed. So I think what I think we'll see, I hope we'll see, is a compromise program, a hybrid, that there are certain areas that are so prone to really explosive fires that unless you're in a concrete bunker, you want to get out. But there are lots of other areas where it makes sense to stay, both to protect the structure and to protect yourself. But you've got to be able-bodied. You have to know what you're doing. It's not mystery. You could do, it's like, you know, you can have an eight-hour course equivalent to standard first aid. Here's what you need to do. Here's how, these are the preparations. But you have to do the preparations and the rest. And we're never going to have enough fire engines. We're never going to have enough stuff to cover things. And I think training a kind of militia like that makes a lot of sense. It's going to be part of our solution. The other side to that is that why not let people be responsible for their own places? And if they know that they're going to be responsible, they will probably take steps to see that it's defensible and so forth. So we're in a large process. The confusion a lot of with the American fire policy scene is not so much a policy but a political question. What are the rights and responsibilities? What is the distribution of those regarding fire throughout the Commonwealth? Who should do what? Who should pay for what? Who should be put at risk? Who should have those choices? And we haven't made those decisions in a systematic way. And the default position is that basically the feds come in with bundles of money and at the last minute are expected to save people. And that's not going to continue to play out. So we need to have this talk, but we also need to have a political system where we can have a discussion, come to some conclusion. It will surely offend everybody in parts, but it will be recognized as legitimate. Maybe not the happiest outcome, the one you wanted, but a legitimate outcome. And that's what we don't have. So that should sound familiar for a lot of things. Why should fire be different? I mean, fire on public land, fire concerning public safety, these are political issues. Politics is not something that's getting in the way. This is where these decisions should be made. And the question is, are the politics any good? Are they open, informed, transparent, honest? Do they have, in a sense, the consent of the governed? And if not, how do we fix the politics so that we can then make these decisions and let these things work themselves out?
Okay, two questions. And
okay.
Then let me remind you, our authors will be available as we dismiss.
Can I ask you, how did the Zen guys not get arrested? I heard that there was people in Big Sur that were trying to save a school there, and a gentleman there was arrested, and I'm just wondering if you know anything about that.
Well, you have the right to stay on your own property in the state of California. They actually can't force you to leave. The gentleman in Big Sur, I don't know who you're referring to, there's someone in the book I talk about who was arrested because he lit a backfire. And there was the question of whether or not that backfire was going to get out of control and cause more problems. The charges were dropped eventually. He was let go. So they weren't breaking the law, but part of what happened for them is that they got to this point where they ran into a firefighter who was part of the command structure that they knew, who'd come down, and they had some connection to him. And he informed them, if you go past me, that's it. You can't go back. And that was the moment of, oh, well, then we are not, you know, some of us are not going past him because somebody needs to be there to fuel these pumps. They were actually technically off their property at that point. They were up the road enough. I don't know why. He didn't have a law enforcement officer with them. He also was sympathetic to their situation, so they went back down. But their right to stay there and do what they did, it was completely legal. I mean, maybe difficult for firefighters, but legal.
Our last question.
Wow.
No pressure.
No pressure. Maybe for Professor Deverell. The arc of the... I'm interested in the arc of public attitude towards fire over the last century in the West.
I may defer to Steve on this, who is truly the expert. But my quick answer to that is that I don't think as much of the public pays attention to fire in the ways that it ought to, so that that arc can actually have a description that rests upon public knowledge and differing public opinion. So we tend to forget fires when they are. We recognize the names if they get names, but we don't remember where they were. It's like earthquakes. You know, we don't have enough of a memory, a public memory, a culture memory about these natural or quasi-natural events to be able to construct an arc based on knowledge. That's my own opinion. Steve?
Well, I think the arc is becoming a circle, frankly. The attitude of most people in the American West at the onset of fire protection 100 years ago or so was in favor of burning. And it was very strong folk interest in burning. Rural America relied on fire. They cleared land with it. They refreshed pastures with it. They heated their houses with it. They illuminated. I mean, fire was everywhere. I can remember visiting my grandmother in San Francisco, and she had a wood-burning stove still. It's only relatively recently that fire, as a part of our vernacular world, is gone. We've replaced it. So there's fire behind all of this stuff, but we don't see it. It's all being transmuted through other forms. And it was an enormous public fight by foresters, primarily, arguing that we represent academic science and we represent progressive politics. This is wasteful. We are going to end it, to fight and convince the public that fire should go on that landscape, because the public was either indifferent or in favor of more fire. They wanted access to fire. Now, as we're no longer a rural society, we've become urbanized or suburbanized, we've lost all of that connection to fire. We see fire as intrinsically threatening and dangerous, because that's how it appears to us in our world today. And now the agencies find themselves having to convince people that fire belongs. And the issue is not to eliminate fire, but to protect ourselves from those we don't want, but promote those that we do.
I probably don't need to remind you all, but this is an institution nearly destroyed by fire 25 years ago that has risen as a phoenix to vibrancy and greatness again through the support of the Library Foundation and great events with remarkably interesting people like those that sit to my side here and those that sit in front of me. So please do remember the Library Foundation. I urge you all to take out membership in further support of this library. And with that, please join me in thanking our two panelists.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.